Okay. The Thursday, July 26, 1973 Christian Science Monitor was just brought to my attention with a front page article on Turkey's Valley of the Gourmet, the churches built into the living rock of this volcanic valley, and the pictures are rather spectacular. It gives you a much wider spread than just the individual shots. I didn't lay on you all of the pictures because, at least as Carol says, this is the last of the series, and we're going to have to rip through about 800 years in a half an hour. So, but I thought you might be interested in seeing that, and anybody who's interested in the Middle East and visiting there, if you're in Istanbul, it's a very short flight over to Ankara, and a day's bus ride from Ankara to the Gourmet Valley, as well as to an incredible a really spectacular underground city, which very, very few people have seen. It makes the catacombs look like sandpile. It's really a remarkable thing. And the underground city and the Valley of Gourmet can all be seen in a nice, easy, and very spectacular day. So you might want to get more information out of this. We'll stick this back in the library where we got it. Okay. Yesterday, or last night, seems like only yesterday, we talked about what is Romanesque about Romanesque. For those of you that have just arrived and are just a tad fearful about things Christian and things art, when Christian and art get together, it's something which is not to be feared. And so the main thrust of our get-together in the evenings is really to have fun, but also to get very, very excited about the heritage of the Christian Church, what people were willing to do, the energies they were willing to expend in order to make praise and to make happy about the faith that was in them. Okay, so we've got a dark age, all right, and then we've got a year 1000, and we've got the year 1000 going past without things drastic happening to the world as a lot of people expected that it would. In celebration of their new lease on life, the monastic system, which was the system holding Europe together, decided to celebrate with buildings, with a tremendous building program, which rivals any kind of international building program that has ever happened anywhere in history, in the East, in the West, in contemporary times as well as in ancient. Just the profundity of design and building in 200 years, from the year 1000 to 1200, is not only spectacular, but very, very enjoyable. The strange thing is that our heritage aesthetically, although it starts at the Renaissance, seems more bent on the Gothic. As Christians, the Gothic still more or less insist on. To give you an idea of what I mean by that, the Air Force Academy Chapel, most of you should be familiar with that, okay? It's Gothic. It's a Gothic building. There is absolutely no way, shape, or form that hints at it being contemporary except for the material that it uses. Not even the way it's made is contemporary, just the material, which is stainless steel and aluminum. And on cold Colorado nights, the thing gets very cold. And then in the warm Colorado days, the thing gets very warm. And the rate at which it goes from cold to warm produces a popping effect, which is not only non-liturgical, it is anti-liturgical. And so the only thing that they did that was modern on that thing doesn't work. It destroys all of the traditional stuff that they did. It's a thing born out of due time. What it's doing there in the middle of a war machine is another question altogether, but I'll leave that for the theologians to debate. All right. I am not sure how many contemporary churches you are familiar with, but I will guarantee you that the wildest, most extreme church that you can think of is, 9 times out of 10, Gothic. Gothic. Yeah, even the one you're thinking of. Yeah. Longitudinal aisle, altar at one end. Now, if it's got a long aisle and it's got an altar at one end, it's Gothic. If the roof comes to a point, it's Gothic. Now that, there ain't much left. There are a few. Oh yeah, there really are a few left. And if Carol lets me continue with this stuff, and as I say, when I get going, I kind of get diarrhea of the mouth, so I could keep going through the winter. I will, but somewhere. I'm basically a coward. I would like to show you contemporary church design and architecture, an evening of what's being done up to the minute. Maybe we can do that next week. But Corbusier's church at Rochon. I don't know how many of you have seen it, Notre Dame du Pont. That's about it. That is not Gothic. That is definitely not Gothic. But we have built Gothic cathedrals out of everything you can think of, including corn cobs. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Wife and kids and I were in the middle of Uganda, down to the mining towns over in Kigezi. That's close enough, right? Yeah, I know. It was a couple countries ago. And there, in the middle of Uganda, were African people coming to worship in a little Gothic cathedral that was made out of timber, all wood, joined and locked together. But it was a Gothic design. In fact, the model of it was of a little church around the corner from in a London parish. There is something sacred about it. There are guys at the seminary in St. Louis. I think they're still there. Who, don't laugh, my father's one of them, who still insists. My father is not one of these, who still insists that Gothic is the closest thing to a spiritual format in which to worship that we can... Pardon? Yeah, they're still in St. Louis. Yeah, they're still there. And I don't know what the complaint is about. Tradition, that's conservatism. And you know, you want to keep guys like that around if you don't want a lot of change to happen. There is this thing about Gothic, and no question about it, the Christian religion has become idolatrous about the whole thing. And if there's anything that I'd like to stress for you this evening, it is that Gothic was of a particular time, and it was even of a very special place, a very special geographical location. Okay, now we went through the engineering thing, and I do ache this morning from those things that we've been trying to describe. Semicircular arches snap. So I'm not going to go through all the gyrations, but we are going to cover some things that lead up to Gothic, namely Romanesque. And as we said, Romanesque is a thing in which, because they're dealing with this half circle, they've got big half circles. And the bigger the half circle, the more stuff you have to pile up against them in order to keep them from pushing out and falling down onto the worshippers. So they've got a tremendous amount of masonry in here. All of this stuff in here. All of this big amount of wall with just a few little openings. A tremendous amount of wall. Another interesting thing that you find, in addition to just simply the amount of masonry, is the amount of detail, which sounds kind of contradictory, but I said it was an age of invention, and it is. So they wound up with all kinds of strange little caps for their towers, and in fact, if you really get into the Romanesque age, all you have to do is look at the cap, and you'll know exactly what region you're in. Black towers, you're either in the north of France or in England. This kind of thing is German. This is a German Romanesque cathedral, and the tower business, it was partly due to fortress defense, but it was very interesting. You know, we talk about, this is another one of our little ways of making symbols that really don't work. We talk about building churches in the shape of a cross, and that, you know, it really is neat if you got a church that's built like a symbol. This comes to ridiculous extremes. They got in Stanford, Connecticut, some of you may have seen it, the church in the shape of a fish. Have you seen the picture? Parishioners call it the Church of the Holy Mackerel. Taking a building form and making a symbol out of the building itself, when actually, as we know, it's got to be the congregation that is a symbol. And for some reason, they misread the whole history and tradition of church architecture. What happened? You got, remember Basilica? It's just a straight, long thing, an altar at one end. And they usually had a little spread around the altar area because they wanted to have the Christians, when it was their turn to celebrate the Mass, to do it around the altar. So they pushed out those walls a little bit, and you wound up kind of like a T with a stubby extension. Okay? But then comes the Romanesque age. Remember, it's the monastery. It's the monastery where all of these things are built. These are abbey churches. You know how it is in the abbey? I don't know why you should, but let me tell you. Well, some of you may be familiar, but every guy has to celebrate the Mass, you know? So you've got all of these guys gathered around the altar. Now, some of these monasteries had 300-400 guys in there. Not only that, but the abbey church was not just for the monastery. It was also for the town. It would be set up on a hill. If people came around and started making messes down below, people all ran up into the monastery and were protected there. And that's where the people worshiped. You had actually two church kinds of dealies going on at the same time. One for the clergy and one for the laity. The clergy occupied this
this nave thing, but that got smaller and smaller because the clergy business got bigger and bigger. Now, where are you going to put the clergy so that they can all worship and celebrate the Mass simultaneously? You spread out those ends of that T. You get them out farther and farther. It was not building a church in the shape of a T. It was designing a form that would accommodate two simultaneous liturgies. In other words, the form followed the function. To make a fish into a church is stupid. It's got nothing to do either with architecture or the tradition of Christian building. Absolutely nothing. So, actually what happens, remember I told you about all of these pilgrims coming and they wanted to go around the sides without disturbing the services? In some of these places, they had to go around the side without disturbing two services. Now, what do you do about that? You spread those aisles out even farther, and eventually you had aisles coming out to the ends of the T. Now, if you were to draw a floor plan of a Gothic cathedral, most of you would probably simply draw a cross shape. But the cross form shape is Romanesque. By the time it gets to Gothic, looking down on a Gothic cathedral is looking like looking down on a shoebox. Those aisles come out and make the T inside of that box, and there is no projection, or at least the projections are no bigger in proportion than they were to the early Christian basilica. So be careful about these little kinds of idolatries that we have, like stained glass. There's a man who's cutting his own throat. Like organs, like pews. We haven't even got to the pew period yet. Or like churches that have to be built in certain shapes. I just had a church, I didn't just, it was years ago, and it took me years to finally give up on the whole thing. An architect south of Milwaukee, a congregation, he did this thing for a congregation south of Milwaukee. An incredible hyperbolic paraboloid concrete bird. A big goose taken off from the side of a hill. It looks like it's ready to flap these big wings, really, seriously. And the congregation came to me after they had dedicated the church, and they said, "We got a problem." No, the church hadn't taken off. It was that they couldn't figure out where to put the altar. Seriously. And I said, "Well, how's about your architect?" And they said, "Well, he told them that he wasn't an interior decorator." So he just left them alone. Well, it takes a stupid congregation to make a stupid architect. You know, I don't know why they got off blaming the architect, because how the congregation ever decided to hire a man who didn't start from the inside out is beyond me. You begin with the altar. That's where you start with the altar, the word, and baptism. You begin with what those mean to the congregation and how do you get them around there. And I mean around. And that church was the only building yet that I have been unable to find a place for the altar. I couldn't do it. The guy was an absolute genius. I mean, I have put altars in garages. I have put them in storefronts. I have put them in libraries. But here was a church, and I couldn't find a place for it. So the general congregation will go window shopping and look for exteriors and say, give me one like that, you know. Only we want our cross to rotate. Amazing thing. Here is the apse. Here is the apse of a little Romanesque church in France. And here are the rooftops of those little side aisles I was telling you about with the little altars that come along. Each little chapel around this ambulatory, it's called a pilgrimage ambulatory, has a relic inside of it. And so the pilgrims come down the side aisle. You can see how it leads into this side aisle here. They continue to pay homage at each of these places, go all the way around, and go down the other side aisle and out the church and down the road. The apse is what we already had back in the basilica. It is the semicircular projection out of the east wall. That's the liturgical east wall. It is the raised platform that extends in this half circle. The altar generally was not on it. The altar was in front of the steps down below, and the bishop's seat was up there, and that's the place from which he instructed the confirmation. Okay? On the apse. Right. I don't know how many of you knew it, but this is Romanesque. And it's just a very good example of the delightful stuff that people did at this particular time. This window here goes into a room that is 6 inches deep. It's a space on the other side of that window which is 6 inches deep. I mean, you can't have a window that goes into just a wall. You have to have it going into a room. But they had other plans for the inside, so they just built a little close room that was only like that. And that's neat. That's funny. Is there anything wrong with it being funny? I frankly don't think so.
But is it useless?
Useless?
So what is it using for? I mean, you said form follows function, follows form.
I think what happens is that they wound up with a change in the bricklayers' union. I'm serious. No, I'm serious about this. Because you find going down this wall, all of a sudden there's a change in color from white to pink. And I don't know how good your eyes are, but if you would follow the line of the top of this blind arcade here, you would see that all of a sudden they go up. Like so. For no structural reason at all. Somebody just decided that the other way was better. And they didn't destroy what they had. They just continued in a new motif. There is the same kind of facade pattern on the other side of the church. I wish I had a slide of it, because there is one of these pillars which is a dog leg. And it isn't that it's broken, because the face is over here and the capital is up here. It leans. And there's no way it can straighten out. It would bust if you tried this. It's just leaning there. In Lucca, the twin city of Pisa, you have every single one of these pillars made of a different design and material. Every single one of them. Up in Bologna, as well as in Ravenna, the Romanesque people built towers like that on a slant. And although it may seem a bit far-fetched, there are still quite a few people who, having investigated the delights of the Romanesque age, have come to the conclusion that this tower was built to tilt, that it started out on an angle. For fun. is because the angle of those of these particular units here changes as it goes up. It adjusts. And it starts adjusting right at the bottom. Strange and tiny. See that adjustment here, and it's obviously, you know, it's continued on its downward journey much beyond the previous or the original plan, if in fact there was one. But if you would check the Romanesque age in Italy, you would find all kinds of examples like that. You've got square ones, seven large square towers in Bologna, the lost city of Italy, all leaning at very cockeyed directions. Here's an interior, and this will give you some kind of an idea of what the Romanesque business is all about. You've got a rather elaborate and complicated inside. There's an awful lot happening down at the viewer's level. You do not have a sense of things going up and continuing around, because there's a large capital. The Romanesque people, because of that Roman veil, still like capitals. And the capitals tended to be a breaking point visually. That changes drastically in the Gothic age. You also tend to have, and this is all changed back here, but over in this area, you can see that pump that I was talking about last night. Each little area is a unit unto itself. It's called a bay. And so you have these successions of pumps as you walk down a Romanesque church. If you don't have, you have a barrel vault. And it's just one continuous long tunnel, looking very much like old railroad stations. And once again, the problem of that is the tremendous weight. And those tunnel vaults are tremendously dark. But can you see when they added a Gothic addition later on, how all of these things wind up at the same height and form one continuous line from front to back? You see that much better in the finished and classical Gothic cathedral. In Italy, they just never did. I really think the Italians are a thing unto themselves. They are a very interesting breed. Because here is a Romanesque cathedral. It's got a Byzantine pentacrator in mosaic in the apse. But this is the most Romanesque thing of all. This is a stairway made of marble. You would have to take a flying leap of 17 feet in order to get to the first step. And once you are on that step, you walk up to here to a door that is painted on marble. There's nothing there. There is no reason for that staircase to be there. Once again, the form following function is denied, but no function, no form. You know, it's a conceit. That's all it is. It's an ornamental conceit. Notice, for example, once again, the very strong capital, that's right out of the Roman temple, and an awful lot of stuff down in this area which tends to break any sense of lift. This is a little side chapel in the Cathedral of Tournai. You come out of that chapel and take two steps, and the third one is easy. Thank you. a marvelous, really for many reasons, a marvelous cathedral because of the invention that these people went to. This is the cathedral that over the main aisle has the barrel vaults running laterally. So you've got that little loopy effect. But over the side aisle, you've got a very, very sensitive intersecting barrel vault with a fantastic brick rib, which is just beautiful and tells us that we are in Burgundy. And these people really knew how. You got to realize that while some of this thing is just pure delight, it's also a tremendous insistence on trying to find out what's possible. And when these people tried to find out, they risked a whole lot. I mean, if you ever take a tour of one of these things, the guide tells you in such and such a year the left tower fell down, in such a year the dome fell down, in such a year the rafters burned. You know, I mean, it's just from one little disaster after another because they weren't quite sure of the process. All they knew was that they had to do it. And they did it. And they did it in some very exciting ways. Now, you've got some other interesting things happening. You've got a variety of gifts, much more so than in Byzantium. In Byzantium, you've got pretty much an exclusive mosaic thing. There is this royalty and the spiritual kingdom and the earthly kingdom together. You would not build a church and then go happy on the expense. It was just all out. But in the Romanesque age, they were trying to figure out other ways of saying this kind of thing that they were thinking. And they did some interesting stuff. Frescoes, for instance. And boy, the Byzantine people would poo-poo a fresco. It was just not worth it. And that's why when they did frescoes in Byzantium, it was always in one of these hideout type of places. But in this particular basilica, Romanesque basilica, you've got some of the most magnificent frescoes, and they're still at work. They're still shining and glowing. And they follow a motif of Mary and also apocalyptic vision. And they also spend a lot of time on the lives of the saints, particularly those that meant interesting ears. The Romanesque age, remember when it started, there is always this judgmental thing hanging over the Romanesque age. Over the cathedral door, on the tympanum, is always Christ on the throne of judgment. You cannot enter the church without coming under the judgment of Christ. And it is more often than not a rather fearful one, showing what happens to the bad guy and what happens to the good guy. It's always thrown up in the faces of the people of this time. Even being a good guy is not necessarily a reward in itself. Awfully sensitive and delicate. These guys who painted the frescoes were not ham-fisted. Their color sense was, I think, beautiful. And boy, this stuff is still around. It's still lasting. And fresco is a very, very fragile medium. But Romanesque is sculpture. No question about it. It's architecture, but more than its architecture, it is sculpture. And here is the entrance to the cathedral at Basilea. We're in the narthex. This is where Peter the Hermit sent everybody out on the crusades. Right from this very spot. And there is Christ on the throne of judgment. And under Christ are the just. And on the lintel, this whole thing right here is a tympanum, a drum, upside down, and this is a lintel here. And on the lintel, a
of this particular cathedral are all the dams. In other words, the dams are easier to look at than the sage as you walk into church. Probably the most important of the Romanesque sculptors was a man whose name you shouldn't forget. Probably one of the first guys whose name we have in the Christian art history business. His name is Gieselbertus. Gieselbertus, who was the sculptor of Altun. And in fact, he wrote his name on this thing, kind of like Michelangelo. He had a sense of his own work. But Gieselbertus is extra special because he breaks the Romanesque mold slightly. He follows a legal and moralistic approach to his art. In other words, we've got to ram this judgment business down the throats of the parishioners. But every now and then, he sticks in something extremely and delightfully human. This isn't delightfully human, but it's extreme. It may even be delightfully human, but I don't think it was for the people in the court. This is one of his devils, and he did a whole series of devils, very close to the people. People were being picked at and tortured. In other words, walking into church should be one of the trials of the Christian. And you pass through temptation in order to get in there. And you have then done a good thing. Check this. The man who is confronting the devil is a liar, or was a liar. He is being held down by one devil, while by another devil his tongue is being pulled out. Okay? Judgment Day, folks, we do not mess around. You will shape up, I won't even tell you what's going on down the lower right-hand corner. A lot of this stuff, an awful lot of it, law, for 200 years, in spite of the delightful building program, the iconography was law. Christ putting the mark of Cain on the man. Christ doing that. Strange. This is Gieselbertus that I'll do. Isn't it in the book of Acts, I'm pretty sure, the magician that tried to be Christ and tried to fly and fell, he's falling. While another devil is waiting for him, and while St. Peter is clicking his tongue, over on this side with the keys in his hand. Look! But that same God, Gieselbertus, did some of the most sweet and lovely things that it makes you wonder where he got his material. What were his influences here? It's a strange kind of thing that you cannot trace. This is not Roman. There's nothing like this in Romanesque. This isn't Greek. Really not. But look at the subtlety of this. Oh, this has got to be one of my very favorite things of all time. He, who is a full, fleshy, sensuous Eve, and yet she is happening in a totally abstract environment. These are not leaves, they are leaf designs, like you saw on manuscript illuminations from the Dark Ages yesterday. And yet she is reaching back. She is not sure about this whole thing. She is reaching back and picking off fruit from a thing that is purely ornamental, and those two things in art, reality and abstract design, are living harmoniously side by side. I know you've got to be kind of an artist in order to appreciate that, but but it is uncanny. The reality of this thing. And yet there are two antithetical ways of describing it. There should be a lie, a visual lie in this thing, and it, there isn't. And it is kind of a miraculous thing. Look how that design over here. Look at how this, that is not the stem of a plant. But it becomes one, and it becomes serpent also. And look how it supports her head. And in the act of reaching, she has already begun to cry. Wow, that's human. I mean, extremely human, and more than just judgmental. One of the great masterpieces in all of art. That's an Altoona, yes. Or look at this. Look at this. I mean, this guy had a sense of humor. Three wise men in bed together. But even more than this. Remember Eve with her arm back, and so you got the eye going one way and the hand going the other. And there's a kind of a tension in organizing that thing. Check this. The eye, and the arm, and the touching of one wise man's hand. His eye is it. It's not just pure design, it's human. It's delicate, and it's very, very subtle. And all of these things were designed for the catapults, 75 feet up in the air, where nobody could see them. He could have been very, very careless, and he opted not to be. That is a master. Oh, Mary and the baby and Joseph going to Egypt. It's a long, hard journey, and so Giselbertus has given the donkey wheels. And remember what I said, art is a process that is always a continuing thing. It's not a thing that has arrived. It's always in a state of becoming. And you can just see this man living between a number of worlds, trying to put them together and extend them another step. So he's got all of this Byzantine ornament for the wheel, all of this abstract design, from the Dark Ages, from those manuscripts for the plant. He's got the baby held in Mary's lap like a Byzantine baby, so that he faces straight out, and he's even got an orb to hold his hand on. So we know that this is the king of the earth. That's Byzantine. And yet Mama is so real, and the donkey is loving every minute. Look at it, the donkey is happy. Remember, it's 75 feet up in the air, and that donkey is still happy. Joseph is not happy. I hope Jean Swihart is here. Does this bring back memories? Telling me this afternoon on the way from the creek about Al trying to lead her around on her horse, you know, and she kept getting the feeling that they were on their way to Egypt. Okay. The fortress thing continues for a while, but the whole thing does have its beginnings, the Gothic thing, in Paris. It was Abbot Suger, spelled sugar, okay, who said, I gotta have more room because Saint Denis is buried here. Saint Denis, the patron saint of France, Wherever Saint Denis is buried, there will be the pilgrims. And my place is too small, so knock out the choir. But don't put back in one of those dingy, dull, cold, drippy choirs. I want light. I want this thing to just explode with light. And they said, sure. And it was just like that. I mean, they did it. And no fooling around. There were a bunch of experiments that had happened in the Ile-de-France at this time, and so they had a little inkling. There was a church whose basement started experimenting with rib-growing balls. And the architects went over and checked out the church basement and said, I think this will do for Abbot Suger. And it did. It worked. And it was remarkable. The Gothic Age would never have happened without the inventiveness of the Romanesque. Never, ever. It did not, as some of us tended to believe, just fall out of the sky one day. It had an incredibly systematic history. This is not Saint-Denis. Saint-Denis is kind of clunky. It's the front of it is very Romanesque. But this is Notre Dame of Paris, and gives you an idea of what happens in the early Gothic. We still have a tendency to want to go that way. So this facade is broken up into three layers. Eventually, you'll find that the facades begin to eliminate those horizontals and think much more in terms of upward thrusts. They can go upward. The new vaulting system will allow them to do that. They went upward as long as they got to Beauvais. And at Beauvais, everything fell in, and they had to go to another medium altogether. Chartres, the queen of the cathedral. And you can still see here in the early Gothic, a continuation of the Romanesque idiom. The thing burns, they continue it in a new age with new discoveries and build a Gothic steeple on one side and a late Romanesque thing on the other.
When did the round window there come into the picture?
The round window is an extension of the wheel window. It's just a more elaborate wheel window which we find almost all over in the Romanesque age. But as they started experimenting with light stonework, because they didn't need all the heavy stuff, they found that the stone could be very fragile, and the more they got into it, the more fragile this stonework became, until eventually you wound up with flamboyant windows, flame-like windows, with almost sinews instead of structure, no supporting structure at all. So this little flowery business here says that we're into Gothic, but that much stonework around it says that we're still very early. The sides, however, are later, and you're not even aware of the stone. Look at what happens to the tympanum. Christ on the throne of judgment, both hands out, but just to make sure, he steps down from the throne of judgment, past the blessed, and past all the damned, and stands on the trumeau, and becomes le bon Dieu, the good God, accessible and available. People rubbed his feet as they walked into church. He was that close. And that is essentially the difference. The inside of the Gothic cathedral becomes the new Jerusalem, the city of light, the city of harmony, the city of balance and symmetry. The whole world is splattered on the outside of the cathedral. And when you enter, you pass that world and come into the new Jerusalem. There's another one. And sometimes over that tympanum, they eliminated the Christ on the throne of judgment altogether even putting things like Mary, making Christ accessible still. Now look what happens to the interior. This is early, but the windows become a little lighter. We have a little bit more of a sense of thrust of some of these veins, right like this one, going up, way up. They had to have a little bit of projection up here in order to support the centering. The centering is what they stretched from one side at this point to the other side, and then they built a membranous thing out of wood, and then laid the vaulting on top, then took all of the centering down, and the vaulting stayed. Most of the time. Look what happens to the outside. You are now able to support the new vaulting system with a membrane which floats away from that wall so that light can get around it, and is just supported by a thin pillar on the ground pretty far away, in fact, outside of that ambulatory. That membrane, of course, is what we call a flying buttress. And in many cases during the war, they found that the bombing destroyed that buttressing system and the walls stood anyway. They didn't even need that. This whole fragile window thing just stood there all by itself. An incredible change. Look at here, at the difference between this and the front row window. Rams Cathedral. You see what I mean by that T shape? Nothing key about this at all. The front side things come out like the side, like this, and there are aisles going on down here, coming all the way around over to connect to the end of that. So if you look straight down on this thing, it would be a rectangle with a curved end. No cruciform at all. Trees of the many forests in which these cathedrals were built. That may be one reason. But you cannot say that this is a universal solution, even at this time. If this was the ideal solution, folks, I think it probably would be true that the closer you get to Rome, the closer you get to Gothic. Rome would have made a stamp of some kind of an approval on this, but it didn't. Boston has better Gothic buildings in it than Rome does. Much better. In fact, it was Rome that called this stuff ancient, decadent. The Goths had been extinct for 600 years when the people of Italy looked up north and saw all of this stuff and called it Goth. Now the Cathedral of Rams, I think, probably shows better than any. The relationship, first of all, of light to space, but also this final insistence upon the thrust. Running from the floor all the way up to the top and down the other side without virtually any interruption at all. No capitals except for very, very minor ones, otherwise just sinews. England had good Gothic. It tended to go horizontally rather than vertically, like here. Or like here, except for one example of the most vertical of the English Gothic, and that's at Salisbury, although even here it tends to spread out a little bit at its base. The Italians didn't dig it at all. They got all of their mosaics all over the front of it, and it looks very The back of this thing is just an old basilica, like the early Christians built, exactly like it. And it's just stuck right on, and then they put this great big fancy elegant front on it, but they didn't know Gothic at all. They didn't. That is Orvieto, the cathedral at Orvieto, and it is really an elegant thing, but it's Italian, and it's not Gothic. It's got to be understood on its own terms. And not how it fits into history. It's a child born out of due time. And their interiors were kind of strange, too. That's the cathedral of Siena. And it's an op. It's an optical wonder there. Sculpture becomes really human. They combine the abstract and the human in a very classical way, like this at random. But let me just leave you with one vision. Think, if you can possibly, of the Gothic cathedral like this, because that's the way